Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Welcome back. We use this opportunity to introduce ourselves to each other. My name is Howard.
My name is Sal.
I'm John.
Nicholas.
George.
Snake.
Clint.
Paul.
Andrew.
Pierre.
Bob.
Buzz.
Steve.
David.
Peter.
Ed.
Roger Mayano.
Bob.
Is anyone here for the first time for the Gay Buddhist Fellowship? Yeah. Welcome. Good to have you here. We also have a host for today, I believe, but I don't know who. Designated. Raphael. He will greet you and
treat
you. Greet you and treat you and fill you in. Well, it is my privilege this morning, first of all, to be sitting in for Jimmy Stewart, who's off on a family gathering, and also the privilege of Donald introducing you to the Sangha. Donald Rothberg has practiced insight meditation since 1976 and has written and taught widely on socially engaged Buddhism and transpersonal studies. He's on the faculty of the Saybrook Graduate School, where he's developed a program in socially engaged spirituality. He has been an organizer and an educator, a board member for the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and particularly working as a member and mentor for its Buddhist Alliance for Social Engagement since its inception in 1995. He's also a meditation teacher, working with the two small groups in the East Bay, and is helping to develop a new Dharma Center in the East Bay. He leads and also co-leads retreats on mindfulness practice and socially engaged Buddhism, both locally and nationally. Wow, what a gift. Donald, thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you. It's a very, very kind introduction, and I've always enjoyed being here and talking with you, and somehow wished that the sessions could be longer. There was always, always get going, and then it's time to leave. And I also want to recognize that this is a particularly sort of powerful psycho-spiritual cultural moment. You know, there's a lot going on. I mean, not only, you know, is there all the turmoil related to the invasion and so forth, and all that that brings about, but it's also Passover, the time of liberation, and Easter today. You know, the time that people reflect on the whole question of life and death and the mortality, resurrection, in a sense, what liberation means. It's also the anniversary, I know, of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, which happened in 1943. Started on April 19th. Some of you may know that. So, in this context, I want to talk about one aspect of liberation, which is perhaps both most obvious to us and most hidden. And that concerns our attachment to views. And so the theme of my talk this morning is embracing paradox It could be subtitled Working Through Attachment to Views. And I want to begin with a short practice that I want to invite you to do, a kind of guided meditation. So if you can make yourself comfortable. I'd like you first just to be present to your breathing and your body. Letting the whatever residue there is from the conversations subside. And I'd like you to bring to mind an experience of the last day or perhaps last few days in which you experience yourself having a strong view. And you would know that you had a strong view by the emotional charge present. So it might be a situation in which you really were convinced that you were right about something, or you were really trying to push your own view, as it were. It could be a view about an interaction, it could be a political view. Could be an aesthetic opinion. Some situation in which there was some charge around your view. So bring the situation to mind, and if you can, let the internal dialogue take place for a little while, sort of bringing back that situation. Let the words be present. And see now if you can move to the level of the body and the heart. And see if you can feel the emotions related to that view. Not so much trying to figure out the emotions, but just for the moment being present in the body and in the heart, and just listening. Now, a reflective question. Can I look at that situation and ask myself the question, what can I learn from the person with the opposite view? Is there something I might be able to learn from that person or whoever holds that opposite view? And another reflective question, are there any ways that I myself hold that view, the view that I was opposing. Maybe not in the exact same context, but maybe in some other part of my life. Is there a way that I myself, in some way, hold that view? Now coming back to presence and at your own pace, if you want, if you've had your eyes closed, you can open them. Maybe a few observations, if you have some. What did you find out from that exercise? Yeah.
I went to Seder for Scott the Pacer. With a group of very old friends, we've known each other for about 25 years. And to my amazement, later in the evening when we had a discussion about world events and stuff like that, there was one person there who was just totally enthusiastic about what.
Yeah.
We were dumbfounded, and I was dumbfounded.
Yeah.
And I saw it instantly what was happening is some heat was coming for me.
Yeah.
I wanted to put out my ideas. I chose not to do that because it's so rare for me to find amongst my friends that position. And in a way, it was a relief to actually hear something, because I know there are people who hold that position. But the piece that I found most interesting in doing this reflection right now was a piece that I do have a great deal of difficulty with, which is the part of me, there is some part of me that wants to begin to let go a little bit of the rigidity and entrenchedness with which I'm attached. It feels claustrophobic.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really allow me to be present to what is true today, because I'm so attached to my feelings about what has taken place yesterday. And so I feel the entrapment. And in a way, when I go back over that, it's like allowing some room for myself to breathe more deeply. Sort of say, you know, this is my experience, which is that almost every idea I've ever had and every emotional state I've been in has had contained in it the opposite of it. It's just my experience.
Yeah.
And to have something be so skewed feels so limited for me.
Yeah. Thank you.
I just noticed that there's something very attractive about the conflict, staying in the conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that I hold powerfully to my view because there's something emotionally satisfying or something about keeping the conflict going. I'm involved in a neighbor problem.
Yeah.
And a noisy neighbor.
Yeah.
I'm unwilling to actually do things that would bring it to an end for me.
That's great. Yeah. No, it's not great, but it's great report.
And I just noticed that there's something about our locking of horns that is satisfying.
Yeah. Thank you. Maybe the last one, Clint?
Yeah, I just want to echo what both these children say. I'm just consumed with what's going on with Iraq, but also the larger thing, just the administration and everything it represents. It's totally consumed with it. And in some way, there is this huge adrenaline rush of anger and rage and righteous indignation and all this stuff. And it is a rush. It's an intoxicant.
Yeah.
And there's no level where I'm just fucking sick of it.
No.
I can't even take a walk in the park and enjoy the flowers without these thoughts just totally obsessing my mind.
Yeah.
And I just want to just get away from it, and I can't. It's everything I
Thank you, Clint. That's I think many of us share that experience, and we'll have, you know, I want to talk some about this phenomenon of attachment to views, and we'll have time to explore those experiences more in discussion. But I think that brings out a lot of what I wanted to explore, certainly the phenomenon. I want to help myself to see ways of being lighter with our views, being lighter with our concepts, to see the ways that we get attached to our views and concepts, why that is, and the possibility of coming to having our practice more fully work with that attachment to views in our daily life. And I think the direction is towards a way of embracing paradox, you might say. What does it look like when we're lighter with our views? It doesn't mean we get rid of all our views, but because in some ways we need views and concepts to function. But how do you have views and be much lighter with them, use them as a place for inquiry, and come to a way of understanding the whole field of views as a kind of interdependent field in which it's possible to experience more directly beyond our views, or beyond attachment to our views, I should say. Some of you know that famous poem by Rumi, which says, there's a field out beyond, I'm paraphrasing, there's a field out beyond our fixed concepts of right and wrong. I'll meet you there. Beautiful, powerful. That's the direction of this practice. And I think it's very well expressed in the concept of the middle way, which is really the heart of the Buddhist teaching. And the teachings are fairly explicit about the dangers of being attached to views. The Buddha, in fact, framed the entirety of the teachings as a way of avoiding two extreme views. Those views in his time were, he said, the view of eternalism, the view that for example, in spiritual realm, that there is an eternal self that exists forever, and that things exist forever. And on the other hand, the notion of nihilism, the things don't exist. I think he was very sensitive to our tendency to want to attach to views, probably out of the anxiety of life. There's something about the uncertainty and ambiguity of this existence that leads us to both individually and culturally form these set of concepts that help us navigate things. And again, we can think that the concepts are in some ways helpful. It's helpful to have stop signs. It's helpful to have red lights, right? It's helpful to have voting booths, you know. Effectively, the Buddha says we use stop signs and red lights, and we come to think that they're ultimate reality, or that we somehow get deeply attached to them. But there's something about the quality of the uncertainty, ambiguity, impermanence of our existence, and the difficulty of us facing that directly, that leads us to get attached, you know. And the fundamental attachment that the Buddha talked about is the attachment to a view that I am, that there is a self here who is sort of eternally existent, that will always be present. And somehow in that, we don't see the reality of impermanence. We want to deny the reality of death. We also want to deny the reality of interdependence, the way that I am very much in dependence with others, with my family, my culture, my friends, with other objects. And we tend to believe that there is a separate self and that there are separate objects. And our language, in a way, you might say, seduces us into thinking that there is a world of clearly defined objects in which I'm here separate from everyone else, and you're here, and my role in life is to sort of manipulate the world so I gain pleasure and avoid pain. And the Buddha says we live in a kind of illusion, that actually our language and our concepts are useful, but they don't really express things as they are. You know, and we can actually see that when we do meditation. You know, we can see, for example, when we're silent and mindful, if we're just even just right now, if you can just be like with an object near you, I can be with this rock, you know, and you're actually mindful of the rock or what we call the rock. And if you actually just are present, like right now with an object in front of you, a cushion, you know, your shirt, and you're just aware of it and present with it, we start to be engaged with a reality in which the concept tends to slide away. The concept is a useful tool. But we can be present with this. I can be present with this rock in terms of all the sensations, which actually are this amazing, alive, buzzing presence of stimuli and sensations, out of which I just say rock, you know. I don't know if I chose this because of the problem in Iraq, but but you know what I'm saying, that we somehow just use the word rock as if, you know, we have this incredibly alive, powerful experience with poets have always taken us further into, and all I say is rock, you know. And it's so limited compared to the reality of the experience, but yet if I was going to start to talk about it, I would use that concept. And so just in our mindfulness practice, we start to be able to be present in a way that doesn't involve this attachment to objects. The great Buddhist philosopher Nagarjuna, who lived in the second century, and some of you may know his work. How many people know Nagarjuna, the Buddhist philosopher? Okay, well, Nagarjuna was perhaps, he's often credited for being the most profound Buddhist philosopher, sort of after the Buddha. And his specialty was taking dogmatic views and deconstructing them. And so what he would do, he's saw that the whole nature of language is dualistic. We arrange the world in terms of sets of polarized concepts, up and down, right and wrong, part and whole, life and death, eternal and temporary, and so forth. And he was convinced that since these views come in sets of opposites, if you actually take a view that's on one side of the polarity, you actually implicitly believe the opposite view. I think we can see this in politics, that when people get in these polarized situations, they actually become dependent on the people they're opposing. You know, it's very clear, you know, what would happen, you know, do you remember when the Soviet Union dissolved? The United States and Russia had profound identity crises because they had been based for so long on relating to their opposites. And the U.S. has, I would say, has struggled mightily to come up with an enemy that has the same power as the Soviet Union used to have. You know, they tried, you know, the drug war, and it really hasn't worked. You know, they tried, you know, making Americans fearful of narco traffickers lurking everywhere, you know, and they reinvaded Panama and so forth, but people have not been convinced, you know. And it's so, from the point of view of sustaining identity, people have a great sense of relief to be able to think that wild-eyed Islamic terrorists, you know, in some ways actually are more fearful than the Soviet Union. There's a great relief there because the identity can be sustained, whether or not the fear has any objective referent. And we can see this, you know, we can see this in terms of our the oppositions that we have. I've been thinking of this in terms of the anti-war movement. Now, there's an interesting article, I think it was in the Guardian a few weeks ago, that talked about how difficult it was for the anti-war movement to find adequate places to protest because the military is more or less pulled out of the whole Bay Area. You know, and it gets very confused to have an opponent when there's, you know, and it's, so the anti-war movement has resorted to, what are they, you know, I mean, there's some virtue in all this, but there's something that I find is, there's a way in which the anti-war movement, as it's mostly constituted, is very dependent on having an enemy that works in a certain way, you know, and so it's been very hard. People have resorted to going to Chevron and Bechtel and so forth, all of which are places that are, you know, probably not doing great things generally. But still, there's some way when we look to conflicts, we see how much the two are dependent on each other. You know, the Soviet Union desperately needing the United States to stay in power, you know, and the United States needing needing some kind of fearful enemy to be able to, for the politicians to be able to do what they want to do. And it's in that context, what Nagarjuna does is he said, take any of your own views, see where you hold them strongly, look at them carefully. And what his work actually was about, he took the main view, strong views of his time, including Buddhist views. And he basically was saying, you can't be free if you have any dogmatic views. And I can show you, if you have a dogmatic view, as opposed to, let's say, a lightly held view, if you have a dogmatic view, I can show you how you're dependent on the opposite view existing for you to hold that view. Again, we can maybe think as examples of some of these political situations. The people who are most opposed, they somehow share, in some ways, they share the same worldview. George Bush and Osama bin Laden share this worldview of good and evil. And they require, you know, they require the evil person, and they also require, having a big shadow so they don't see their own evil. Right, and so the skillful therapist or philosopher would show anyone who has a dogmatic view, which means all of us, that if you really look into it, because it's based on anxiety and wanting to create an identity, it actually implies its opposite. And this is what that practice can be. And maybe you saw that some in your own exercise. And so in that context, looking into our views is such a powerful part of our practice. And the exercise that I gave at the beginning is a very brief exercise that really comes out of some of my own experience, which of really taking our own strongly held views as a starting point for practice. It's something we don't always do. I learned this in the late 80s. I was part of a group called Revisioning Philosophy. I actually have a philosophy doctorate, and I was part of this group which was sponsored by Esalen and had people like Houston Smith and Michael Murphy was one of the people who was, you know, the founder of Esalen was one of the people who was bringing it forward. We had about 20 or 25 people, and we would gather. And I remember being very influenced by a man some of you may know named Robert McDermott, who used to be president of CIIS. And he gave us an invitation in this practice. He said, okay, we're going to be here together. We were doing 3 or 4 days together. We're going to be here together. And there are going to be a lot of views said. And in fact, you know, you might say that all the philosophers are actually paid for having strong views. You know, you might even say sometimes there's encouragement. The stronger the views, the more you're paid. As a teacher, in a way, I'm also, you know, paid for having views, you could say, in a sense. So anyway, he said, okay, you all have views. And there are strong tendencies when we're in this interactive group. When I have a strong view and someone else says something and I feel a charge, or I feel, oh, that's not right, I have to say this, or, you know, how could that person say that? You know, or some sort of, you know, some sort of emotional reaction. Robert's invitation was, can you take that as a start, that noticing of difference and some charge, can you take that as a starting point for inquiry rather than war? And for me, something really shifted when I heard that. And I said, that's so beautiful, you know. How can we do that here? How can I do that in my own life? How can I do that in my teaching? So sometimes in my teaching with people, especially when we're dealing with something that's difficult or controversial or there's strong views, I invite people, you know, over the course of time together to do internal work at the same time that we're talking about ideas and views. To do the internal work of looking at your views and seeing what the charge is about. And it's possible, I think this is, for me, this is part of the heart of making our practice come alive in our daily life, which is, how can I have, at the same time that I'm acting externally in the world, how can I also be tracking what's happening internally? Doing that in a variety of settings, to me, is the heart of making this practice come alive in our daily life. And what I learned better and was exploring, how do you do that in relation to views? What you can do in that, what I found I could do in that context is, okay, I'm in this conversation. Can I keep some attention going so that when someone says something that I really feel a reaction towards, I can have some internal attention? I may need to take a bathroom break to really get stabilized in my attention. But can I sort of say, wow, that had a big impact? Is there something I can learn from this person? What's going on? What's my emotion here? Why is that so strong? And can take that noticing of charge and difference as a starting point for practice. It demands a lot of mindfulness to do that. It demands a mindfulness to be aware of strong views. It demands the intention to do it and keeping that intention alive. And also involves a lot of mindfulness to actually track ourselves internally in the midst of action. This is not a beginning ability for most of us. You have to really be fairly stabilized in mindfulness to be able to track internally. But when we do that, for me, it's been a wonderful practice that's incredibly illuminating. And we can explore all of that territory that people were mentioning. The territory of seeing how much I like the conflict. How much is that keeping something going in myself? How much does it help my identity? How much do I sort of like the anger, the sense of being right, and so forth? So this is a very powerful practice that I invite you to. I do want to say that there are some dangers of this practice. And there are some dangers from being attentive to views and where we're attached to views. The first danger is that we can think that views don't matter, or that all views are the same, or that you know, anything goes in terms of views. And that perhaps as I say this, you may feel a little bit of vertigo, right? Well, if I don't hold tightly to views, you know, what's going to happen? You know, what's, you know, how do I live? Does that mean that, you know, my views are just as good as John Ashcroft's?
Wow, that hurts.
Or, you know, so what's, you know, am I just adrift in this field of anything goes? And I don't think that's what this is pointing to. That there's some way that the practice here is actually not one of creating another view that's called all views are the same or no views matter, because that is a view itself. And Nagarjuna pointed this out when he said that the greatest danger was to become attached to his teaching of emptiness. He said it was like picking up a poisonous snake by its tail, because it's actually pointing not so much to attach to a new view about the total relativity of views, but it's actually pointing to going into that field that Rumi talked about, the field beyond the opposites. And it's really related to a second danger, is this can be something that gets very cerebral or heady. I think it's actually pointing towards towards having concepts and views not dominate our lives so much, and towards having being able to be more in that meditative space that I might be in with this rock when I'm really being present. Can I be present with another person with different views without being attached to views? It's really about more a full presence beyond being attached to views that actually can involve the heart opening up as well. And so one of the second danger is that criticizing the attachment to views can become something very heady and can lose the aspect of the heart and can also lose the aspect of action. Because what this is pointing to is more going into a space that's there when we work through our attachment to views, which is actually a space of compassion. It's a large space in which we see the relativity of views. We see the way that attachment to views leads to suffering. We also see how views are helpful and useful in a limited and relative way. And we have our hearts open with this it's really the human situation, that here we are in this life, and in some ways, none of our concepts and ways of thinking this is real ultimately work. You know, this is sort of the moment of existential quandary. You know, that humans have this tendency, and there's actually, I brought in a quotation from Kant, who says this very well. This is how he begins the Critique of Pure Reason. Human reason has this peculiar fate that in one species of its knowledge, it is burdened by questions and concepts which, as prescribed by the very nature of reason, it is not able to ignore, but which, as transcending all its powers, it is not able to answer. He was talking about metaphysical questions, questions about who am I, what is real, what's right, what's wrong. He said, we are unable to avoid asking these questions, but they cannot be answered on their own terms. And for Nagarjuna and the Buddha, this takes us in a way to a field beyond domination by concepts, which is guided by compassion and guided by an ability to see all this in a larger perspective. And in that, with that compassion, we don't use this seeing through attachment to views as a reason to just sort of go off and do nothing. The Buddha said, those who see emptiness are conscientious. They're guided by ethics and they're guided by compassion.
We have about 10 minutes.
Yep. I was going to bring it to an end. So I think that's the quandary. It's maybe we don't have to think out all the most profound implications of the ultimate emptiness of views, but to begin to take inquiry into views as a practice and see what's there and see what we find when we do this practice of looking into views. So I think I'll stop there. Yes.
Well, you led me to sort of a core belief because I'm really freaking, you know, about what's happening, and I'm trying to figure out what's the core belief that's causing the freak, and it's that the United States, because so many of us are compassionate, can never get into a position like this. This can't be happening. You know, it's sort of super duca. And, you know, I've had one or two seconds of realization that this is dukkha and that we're not impervious as people or a nation to it, and to, you know, the suffering from attachment to beliefs on a very large scale. And it helps a little bit to make me feel less crazy.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't really nullify the pain, but it keeps me from freaking like this can't be happening.
Yeah.
Well, it can, because this is dukkha on a very big scale for a lot of us.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, I think that guy I went out with really doesn't, you know, have the same charges as I do for him, you know. It sort of makes all that stuff seem minimal compared to the scale of the dukkha that's happening now. And our country has been so free from it relatively compared to other nations that, you know, so like, I hope that this situation becomes less toxic.
Mm-hmm.
But we're, you know, I'm in a world where this dukkha exists, and it's actually quite liberating to try to keep that in mind, you know, that I'm going to have to operate in situations that when dukkha is.
So if I can respond, I think we all have to do that inquiry a lot. I've been doing several times doing day-longs related to the, I don't even like to call it the war. I like to call it the invasion. But I've been doing day-longs, and I think what's really crucial, this practice here, I think, is key. If you can identify the belief, then you have to hang out with the dukkha. And there are, you know, there are a lot of practices, and some of them are best done collectively to be with the pain of the situation. And that is, I think that's the ongoing work that we do. And a Buddhist practice helps us in that way. It helps us to, so it'd really be to identify the belief and feel what the pain is. And it might be the pain, you know, this country is doing things which I don't want it to do. And it's whatever, however you say that. And then you can have, could have the opposite, you know, could have the opposite view as well. And it's very, very painful. You know, it's very, very painful because how can, you know, you might say, how can I belong to this? Or how am I complicit? Or I can't believe this is happening. And then to somehow to be in touch in some way with the emotions, and to hang out with them, it helps to work through and make it not so much happening on the level of beliefs. It helps to have, I think that's the first answer. It's to really be with what's painful in some way, both individually and if you can collectively. And then that has its own course, because one can see how much a belief is sometimes dependent on not wanting to be with what's painful. And when you can be with what's painful, the belief may shift. You know, it may be, oh, I really want this country to be this way, but this is real. This is the way it's been. This is what's happening. And how can I have those two together? You know, how can I hold those two together? Yeah, Clint, and then Steve.
Well, I was just saying, yeah, I'm involved in this program called the Diamond Heart Program. And
yeah.
I mean, it's, and part of the program is seeing, they call teachers, they don't like the word therapist, but it's teaching and working with issues. And I just was in, the last time I saw them, I was just going on about how I'm obsessed by this stuff. And he said, and they're very much involved with, well, what are you feeling? And, you know, what are you going? And so he would direct me to what I'm feeling, and then I would go off about George Bush and his policies, and I'm feeling, I would go off about some other George Bush and his policies. And he said, why are you always bouncing off into this stuff? You know, what are you feeling? And it was just really interesting to do that, because I was thinking, okay, where is this coming from? How can I personalize my reaction? And I was thinking, I mean, I'm going through all my life as a gay man, where I have these people out there who are acting in a very self-righteous way, telling me that I'm worthless, that I'm sinful, that I'm sick, that I need to be changed. And they are the people who are molders of opinion, who are putting the word out about how our culture should define gayness. And when I think about it, I see these are the same people that are going over to Iraq and going over to the Middle East and saying, you know, Islam is, I'm not really defending Islam because it has some strong homophobic elements too, but I'm saying, here's our culture going over the other culture saying, we're going to change you, we're going to overpower you, we're going to tell you to do things the way we see it. And, you know, it's just really interesting to see how much of my personal experience in my own life as a gay man is very much caught up in my political views about what's going on in this war. And when I had that realization, it does make it less of a cerebral, less of an intellectual kind of firefight, and more of a just kind of like seeing what my own reaction, my own life history is involved in my feelings about politics.
You know, I've been influenced a lot by the work of Joanna Macy. Some of you may know her work, and I've actually used one of her practices called the Truth Mandala. Some of you may know that, which is a very powerful ritual, which usually lasts about an hour and a half, in which people, I won't describe it in detail, but it creates a large space of a circle in which, in the context of maybe a day of working together, in the middle of the day, people come together and there are four quadrants, and one is related to anger, one's related to sadness, one to fear, and one to confusion and emptiness, and has a cushion in the middle. And people are invited, in the context of difficult experiences, to come forward and just let be present what's there. And I've done this twice in the last 3 weeks with groups of people. And it's very, it's amazing what's there, what comes out. There's all of us. All of us, in a way, have this immensity of feeling that we're all walking around with, that we don't have very many places to express. And this, doing this kind of ritual, found a few things. First of all, most of us have a lot of that that's right there. Secondly, the personal and the collective come together in the heart. Like when one goes into the pain that you feel, it's like, just like you said, you go into the political pain, you're going to find the personal pain. They're quite connected. It was very amazing to just see how that works, you know, to see how that works. And it comes out in those kind of practices in a very intense way. And the third thing is that going into what's there, I mean, this is the core principle of Buddhist practice, that if you can go in with presence and awareness and kindness to the areas of pain, healing and transformation happens. That's the core of this work that we do. And so if you can look, you know, and what we don't have, or we don't have these containers to work with collective pain very well. And that's what I think these practices I was describing give that. But one finds that, and I have personally found that if I go into that territory, it really frees me up to act more clearly. And I found that I've had two needs in the last few weeks. One of them is to really work with the strong emotions that are there. And I've been graced to be able to do this work with groups. And the second is to be able to act, to have some sense of acting. And I've been really loved being able to work with Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And as some of you know, we've had a strong presence at the demonstrations. And it's amazing. You know, one of the demonstrations, the one right after the invasion started, we had 400 people meditating for 3, 4, 5 hours before and during the demonstration. It was a very, very powerful to act and to work with the emotions. I think those two are minimum to have some degree of balance in these times. Last question, Steve?
Yeah, thank you for what you said. I'm just thinking that the most effective advocates for social justice in American history were people of extreme views.
Yeah.
William Lloyd Garrison in slavery, Susan B. Anthony with suffrage. That matters to me. That point about all views become wishy-washy is an important critique.
Yeah.
Social justice demands extreme views, and that's part of the mix.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And those people were known for extreme views.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how that fits into it.
So how does that, what's the difference between extreme view and being attached to a view?
I happen to think they were right.
What?
They were right.
Like take someone like Martin Luther King. Okay. Is there, would you say, that's a very strong view. It's a view people should not be oppressed because of 1, 2, 3, 4, right? And is that a view that he was attached to? It's an interesting question.
I'm misposing the question. The ethical things you raise at the end are important.
Yeah. Because there's something, and I'm not saying this is all worked out, you know, and it may be that this kind of question is something that we all have to sit with. Because I'm not, you know, Nagarjuna was not a social activist. But there's some, but you have the example, I'll just say you have the example of the Buddha talking about lack of attachment to views and then working in an incredibly dedicated way for 45 years to free people, you know, who are king. And maybe it's better to leave that as a question. You know, I entitled the talk Embracing Paradox. And maybe the paradox is, can you really act out of compassion? I think it's really about, I think maybe the true answer to the question is, what does attachment to view mean? And partly what it means is thinking that the opposite view is a sign of evil or wrong. And I think this may be a way to work with your question. It's an intriguing question, isn't it? You know, take someone like King. He had a view, but in a way, he didn't buy in to the notion of polar opposites. You know, right on one side, wrong on another. He wanted to, his practice was not based on showing the wrongness of the other person. It was more saying that there's something about my view which helps to lead towards divinity, and a person who has an opposite view is welcome also. That's maybe I would want to just end. We could get into a very interesting intellectual discussion here, and maybe we should reserve that for after we finish. But I think that's where I would go. It's really to say, when you have a strong view, how do you know if you're attached to the view? A lot of it is, what do you do with the people who have the opposite view? And if you can have that strong view and not create opposites, that may be cutting through attachments in some way. Because I know that, I was thinking of King and Gandhi. They were very conscious of this. They did not want to make enemies of their opponents. And that's part of what it means not to be attached to views. And yet, they acted. I'll leave this as a koan. Next time, we'll see how we've resolved it.
Donald, thank you very much for this work. Our host?
What am I supposed to do? I'm sorry.
I just want to
invite everybody to have a tea, beverage, and some goodies to go with it.
Remind you that we have a Donna Bowl outside and welcome your gifts, a minimum of $5 more if you are able. And are you hosting folks for lunch afterwards?
I'm not.
You're not paying? sometimes afterwards,
sometimes a group seem to form and decide to go and have lunch together.
I have a few announcements. One is I brought some Buddhist Peace Fellowship recent journals, and they're available for sale for $5 each. There's an envelope here. And secondly, if anyone is wanting to do a retreat soon, I'm helping John Travis with a retreat that's actually next weekend, a 3-day retreat up at Bodega Bay. And I have some flyers for that. It's low cost, and if you need a retreat to deal with, you know, life and yourself, it's a good opportunity. And then lastly, I'm going to be doing at Spirit Rock probably at the end of May a day long related to the war that will do some of the practices I was talking about. And I'll send an email with the information when we have that worked out.
Yeah. Announcements?
Yeah, if you're looking for a break from all this crazy energy and you don't want to go to the Dago Bay, next Saturday we're doing our annual Chimney Rock Wildflower Hike. The details are described in the newsletter, but in case you have a newsletter, there are flyers out there describing that too. This is a season where the wildflowers are out in full bloom. It's a beautiful place. It's a fun day to do. It's going to be a potluck, so if you go, please bring something. We'll be meeting here at 9 o'clock Saturday.
I want to invite everybody every Friday night at the South Beach Cafe in San Francisco. I'm playing piano, and I'd love to have friends and join me. I'm going to be there from 6:30 till 9:30. South Beach Cafe is on Embarcadero and Townsend. So it'll be this Friday and every Friday. So please come.
Act of grace. Can we dance when you play?
You can do whatever you like.
Any other announcements?
And a reminder that talks are available on the internet at the GBF website, kbuddhist.org.
If we could stand and form a circle, and Donald, if you would give us a closing blessing.
Being present to our bodies and our hearts and our minds, our consciousness, letting whatever was valuable or important from the morning, from the sitting, or from the talking discussion, letting that be present. Is there anything that we form as an intention that we want to see what we've learned and take that further? And so we offer the morning, our work together, we offer really our lives for the awakening of all, for the opening of the compassionate heart, for the strong community that helps us to navigate these difficult times and the challenges of being a human being. Warren wants to share love. So we offer this morning, our time together, our lives, for the awakening of all beings, for freedom.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.